Welcome to the Running AI Podcast, Episode 3. We sit down with Dr. Tummel Pereira of the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California. And in this episode, he's going to discuss with us how AI is already being leveraged to better understand the smallest movements of even the tiniest organisms, including that of a fruit fly. This is Episode 3, and we hope you enjoy it.
All right. Welcome to the Running AI Podcast, episode number 3. And joining us today to be interviewed is Dr. Tummel Pereira from the Salk Institute in San Diego. Thanks a lot for joining us, Tummel.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Tummel, maybe could you give us a little bit of a background in your role with the Salk Institute and maybe just your professional background as well?
Sure thing. So I'm a principal investigator and Salk fellow at the Salk Institute in San Diego, where I run a lab that leverages deep learning and computer vision to tackle a variety of different biological problems. My background is in computational biology. This is what I did my undergrad in, and I just recently completed my PhD in neuroscience at Princeton.
And when you went to Princeton, did you know that you were going to get into like studying computational biology? Was this something that's been in your veins or blood like for a long time?
Yes, definitely. I kind of came into grad school with a pretty clear idea of what I wanted to do. I was kind of fortunate to be getting into neuroscience and computational neuroscience at a very unique time for the field. It was around 2014 when President Obama had just launched the BRAIN Initiative, just this huge, huge initiative, which is very forward-thinking. And it brought together all the top minds in neuroscience to define the future of the field. They produced a report called BRAIN 2025. We're almost there, which is crazy. But essentially, they outline exactly where neuroscience needs to go in order for us to be able to really make some headway in understanding the brain and consequently what happens when it doesn't work correctly. The big emphasis in how this connected to my current work was on technology and technology development. So whereas a lot of research funding in the past was very oriented towards solving disease X, understanding what gene Y does, understanding, you know, very kind of like narrow but very goal-oriented types of inquiries, it didn't really work in neuroscience because we just don't know a lot of the fundamentals. And it was a recognition that we needed to build tools and technologies in order to really breakthrough and start making real innovation in understanding the brain. And a large component of that was, of course, building new computational tools and technologies, which seemed like a huge opportunity for me. Mm. And I combined that with the work that I was doing at the time, leading to the research program that I developed in neuroscience and now more broadly to biology.
Cool. So you mentioned computer vision. You mentioned deep learning. So could you take us a little bit through, like, how did you apply those to like the neuroscience field? Because I mean, yes, we all know that neuroscience, especially computational biology, right? There's a lot of AI happening there. There's a lot of deep learning happening there. So let's dig into that a little bit.
Yeah. Awesome. I think there's often this sort of, honestly, a bit of a meme, I think, in the neuroscience community where we kind of tend to make fun a little bit of the computer scientists who analogize the brain to a computer and, you know, think that biological neurons can be reduced to essentially, right, like matrix multiplications, what you would otherwise be like a, you know, a simple, like artificial neural network type of neuron. And it's true that it is not a correct abstraction, but let me get back to this whole topic of modeling the brain in a second. The thing that really got me into this field was definitely from the computer vision side. And the problem I wanted to tackle was, how can we quantify behavior, particularly animal behavior, where we can't ask them to, you know,
explain.
Fill out a question. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To explain, tell us what they're feeling, why they did something, and so forth, right? Something that we can kind of rely on with humans and really undergirds the entire field of psychology, if you want to think of it that way. So how can we do that when we can't really communicate with our animals in English? And I started getting into started to think about this problem when I was working with fruit flies, Drosophila melanogaster. They're really tiny. They're only a couple of millimeters big, and they have a surprisingly complex brain. They have 100,000 neurons in their brain, as compared to the 80 billion that we have, admittedly. But yet 100,000 is still incredibly difficult to try to understand. So they exhibit quite a few interesting behaviors. They have like a courtship ritual. They'll fight over territory. They could search for food over, you know, really long distances. And overall, they have a really intricate, I think, patterning in their movements. I think people have heard of like the honeybee dance, right? Where they indicate, yep, like which they dance to communicate which direction food or something like that is relative to their hive. And fruit flies do a lot of similar kinds of things, perhaps not as sophisticated as that kind of, you know, kind of compass dance, but nonetheless, still rather complicated if you want to just sit down and watch a video or fruit fly. And by the way, this applies also to mice, to other kinds of organisms. But if you just sit down and really start watching them and trying to come up with a code, if you have to write down like a computer program that could simulate and reproduce the exact movements, right? You know what? Not even that. Let's just say even recognize it, right? Write down like a regular expression, like a grammar that can describe all that patterning. You'd have a really hard time, as I quickly learned. I was initially just like, oh yes, we'll do some, you know, some image processing. We'll do some PCA on whatever the outputs are, and we'll figure it out. That's going to be the behavior patterns. It turns out, definitely not. And part of the reason is that they have quite a, you know, all animals really have a shared quality, but all animals that have a central nervous system or specifically a brain all have a shared evolutionary purpose to having this. And that is to move, right? Before there were brains, organisms evolved a nervous system specifically because they faced the evolutionary pressure of not being able to react to the environment well enough. They couldn't see what was in front of them. They couldn't run away from predators. They couldn't, you know, search for food. So evolution drove the development of brains, not just to perceive the world, but to react to it. And the way that the brain interacts with the world is through movement, is by controlling the body. So very fundamentally, you know, all the way down to like the you know, to very simple organisms, up to even us as humans, really the main way the brain interacts with the world is, you know, without question, movement. So that led to this idea that, well, if we want to understand the brain and all of the brain's outputs are movements, it would stand to reason that it would help a lot if we could quantify all of the movements that an animal is able to elicit. And this seemed like a rather challenging task at the time. But I took inspiration when I just randomly was watching some like behind the scenes type, you know, footage of some, I think Avatar or some other, you know, highly produced Hollywood movie. And I saw that they were using motion capture technology to be able to track all the little points on, you know, the actors' faces and all their individual body parts. Because at the end of the day, they were kind of faced with almost exactly the same problem. They put humans in motion capture suits, all those little balls, retroreflective markers, and a ton of cameras so that they could capture where the position of all their body parts were, so they could re-render that in post, right, to create all these avatars. So my question was, well, why don't we do that with animals?
I mean, this is like a computer vision dream, right? This is what computer vision is built for. But that would require like amazing amounts of compute power to do that. Did you just have that available?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there were several challenges. This is like still relatively in the early days of deep learning, right? We're only like a couple
when
of
are,
years
When
out
are we
from.
Talking about? When are we? How far back are we going right now?
Yeah, we're talking like 2014, 2015, right?
Yeah, that's going back in the world of deep learning.
Yeah, that's only a few years after Kuchevsky, right? Until the ImageNet, since the ImageNet moment. And to be frank, like it took a little while for, you know, all the old computer scientists to begin to really be converted. It seems crazy now today because, you know, you can't really do anything without tripping over a neural network. But at the time, it was really thought that, you know, it's going to be a niche thing. It works when you have only like really big data and you have really big compute. Those are definitely some of the challenges I think that we have to face in our own work, for sure. But
if you go way back then, were you using GPUs already?
I was, yeah, definitely. And this was obviously it was not at the Google scale. That wasn't the kind of compute power I got to experience until much later. But we were just using consumer grade, you know, NVIDIA GeForce type GPUs. I've always been a big PC gamer, so always built my own computers, and I was always very familiar with the landscape of GPU computing. And so it seemed like a natural extension. I also happened to be doing like some like GPU computing in my undergraduate work for genomics and other kinds of work that wasn't deep learning related.
Okay. And so in terms of your field, where would you say we are today? From 2014 to now?
Yeah, it's definitely feels like light years. Yeah.
Heist, can we leap that far already?
Hey, okay? I hate to relate it back to Run AI, but hey, the future faster, right?
The future faster right there.
Yeah,
that's definitely light years.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll just say that initially the problems we had to solve definitely had to do with scale, right? Like, you know, consumer grade GPUs weren't exactly super scalable because you need all the extra infrastructure around it, right? And not many places had that. It was kind of thought at the time that you need a Google scale like GPU cluster to be able to practically do deep learning. But what we found, and I think there's been a lot of empirical and early theoretical work coming out in the recent years, is that the compute requirements and the size of your neural network can actually scale really, really well with the size of your data. So that means that if you have small data in a constrained domain, you actually don't need a ton of compute resources. If you have, provided that you're already kind of like somewhere close in the solution space. Of course, for us to be able to do that, we did have to take advantage of a lot of GPU resources to do the experimentation and engineering. But now what the result has been is that we've developed a software that is able to do this kind of like unconstrained motion capture that I was describing, the ability to capture all the movements of animals. And I'll just say that in terms of progress,
8 years later,
eight years ago, I remember being at a conference with all the top people in this behavioral quantification field. And I was chairing a panel discussion, and I asked the panelists, like, they're really all the top guys, right? Like Harvard, Princeton, whatever. Right? And I asked them, do you think we'll ever be able to do, you know, body part specific tracking, like motion capture of individual limbs? This general problem that computer science is often referred to as pose estimation. And they laughed and thought like, and said, no, we're not ever going to be able to reach that because we're never going to have that scale of data or compute. Well, here we are now. It's actually something that's incredibly popular. It is almost becoming like a de rigueur, right? Like a standard in the field where you basically have to do this kind of analysis in order to be, you know, taken seriously as a when you're reporting you. Behavior results.
Do you remember the people? Do you remember the people you asked that question to?
I do. I don't think they'd appreciate me being.
No, no, no. I wouldn't bring them up right now. But I'm wondering, do you know them personally, and would you be?
Oh, I do. They're close friends. Like it's okay. Awesome. I mean, lots of them obviously have, you know, since then been converted to the gospel of animal pose estimation.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah.
So you mentioned software. So this is fun, right? This started out with fruit flies, and now you're talking about software that can track it of, I'm guessing, any animal.
That's right. If it moves, you can track it.
So could you talk a little bit more about that? Like what is happening there? What's the type of software you're talking about?
Right. So we, you know, in order to make this kind of technology more available to the standard, you know, biologist, neuroscientist who might not have, you know, a super strong background in computer science, we developed an open source package called Sleep, S-L-E-A-P. You can check it out at sleep.ai. And we designed it really for usability and accessibility, right? It's a desktop. It has a desktop-based GUI where you just drag and drop your video on there, and you just click on the points that you want it to track, right? You go to a few frames, you can label as few as like five images, right? I can do a demo for you here in like 3 minutes. I just recorded one earlier. And what Sleep takes care of for you is to transform those annotations plus the images that you've dropped in there, which again, it does not have to be specialized. It's just literally an MP4 of whatever. You can record your cat with your phone, you can track it, right? Click on the points you want to track, say the tail, the eyes, the ears. And then you go in the menu, you click on run training, and we've kind of selected a set of really high level hyperparameters that through extensive experimentation, we've discovered are the crucial components to be able to train neural networks with so few labeled examples. It'll then set everything up for you on the back end, and you get to just monitor the progress. You'll see what the tracking looks like in real time as it's training. And over the course of like 5 to 10 minutes on a desktop GPU, it'll spit back out a trained neural network that now you can run on your entire clip or your entire video. And now you know where the body parts, where these interest points are in every frame. That is the core of how it works. What you do with all this positional information is a whole other side of it. And we have exciting ideas of the kinds of things that we're building with it, but people have really done and literally everything that we could think of and a bunch of stuff that we did.
So yeah, so it's open source, which of course is very, very cool. It's the opening up to the community. Have you already received some, let's say, external interest and even know how some of the people are applying it right now?
Yeah, for sure. I get emails literally every day of people asking whether it can work and then also telling us how it broke, because as any software,
yeah,
surely as a software company, you guys can appreciate, you know, no matter how many tests you write, you know, something is still going to break in a machine learning system.
Especially 100%.
Yep.
So yeah, we got to be exposed a lot to what the kinds of applications. That's how we came to learn about all the kinds of cool things. Like, we don't have much, you know, telemetry or anything like that really built in. Probably should have in retrospect. But in just from users reaching out, sometimes just to thank us for, you know, enabling some cool work, we've learned about all the cool stuff people are doing. They're tracking cells, giraffes, fish, flies, mice, rats, monkeys, plants. That's been a crazy one. Since yeah, plants do move, just very, very slowly.
All right. So now let's look out another decade from now.
Uh-huh.
And where your field will be. What is your prophetic brain telling us?
Yeah,
what do you think we're gonna see in 10 years?
Yeah, there's a couple of pretty exciting directions. One is definitely like, you know, we're not at the end of the road when it comes to, you know, markerless motion capture. I think one point that perhaps didn't stress enough earlier is the fact that, you know, we can't really ask our animals to wear a motion capture suit. Like we can't, you know, ask let's say Will Smith. So if you want to record a fruit fly slapping its partner, which we really very often do, we can't ask it to wear motion capture suit for us to be able to capture that motion, right? So a lot of this is really dependent on building better computer vision that can recognize, you know, these types of anatomical features, these landmarks, with very little context and certainly with no external markers that we can use as context clues. So the things that are missing, I think, still in the computer vision side are 3D. We still can't do 3D really, really well. Certainly not as well as we can in humans from single camera. Although there are definitely certain approaches that are getting us there. I think that'll be a big area for growth in the next few years. Full body like mesh capture rather than just
that
the
mean?
Right. Sorry, so rather than just that? The interest, definitely. So like I said, we've been contacted by people working out with every different kind of organism, including things like, you know, like octopus or other kinds of cephalopods that have very squishy bodies and don't have like a rigid skeleton. So it's very difficult, you know, as a human to go and click on the individual points that we want to track, because there are just many animals that have very like non-rigid body parts. And so it's really difficult for us to be able to track those because we don't have like articulated points of movements like your elbow, you know what I'm saying? Like
yeah,
that's very clear and unambiguous. So the solution to that is to be able to capture their entire shape, right? Without not just a single point, but the entire volume. If you imagine that encompasses your body. And this is definitely something that, you know, is done a little bit with humans and in other domains, but it's still really in its infancy. Once it really develops, it will be the true, like, you know, end all be all of motion capture. Because it will, at that point, be able to capture every little detail of movement, even the ones that are just of soft tissue rather than just, you know, skeleton. And finally, I think the thing that I'm most excited about, and this is a core area of research in my lab, is to finally connect all this stuff back to the brain, which, as I mentioned in my motivation, right? If the point of the brain is to produce movement, and now we can capture movement really well, how can we, like, you know, use that to reverse engineer the brain? And one of the coolest emerging approaches to take advantage of this motion capture technology is to use that to this kind of data to drive agent-based models of an entire animal, right? So now we've come full circle to neuroscientists originally making fun of the notion that neural networks can model the brain, to what we're now finding is that actually they're actually pretty good models of the brain. In fact, there, it turns out, some recent work in the past 5 years has demonstrated that they're actually remarkably good models of the brain, because it turns out that you can encode the kinds of inductive biases that you would see in biological neural circuits by manipulating the neural network's architectures. And this is something that you can't really do very tractably using classical modeling techniques. And you can't write down an equation that describes the full connectivity of a complex brain circuit, but you can ask a neural network to learn it. So the idea is we take our motion capture data and we use that, just like they do in Hollywood, to drive simulations of our animals interacting in their natural environment. But importantly, we ask a neural network to be able to reproduce all those movements in the simulation. So in the same way that if you play a video game, you're moving your avatar in a virtual world, but you can also ask a neural network, as DeepMind, for example, often does, to play that video game and try to learn how to reproduce those movements. Mm-hmm. So the idea is we're going to be able to point the camera at an animal, capture all of its movements, reinstantiate that in a virtual agent that plays a video game of the real world. It can act and behave like the real animal, but is now being driven by a neural network. And what that's going to allow us to do is to then probe the neural network, ask what it's thinking, where now we have access to the entire neural network. You'll be able to point a camera at an animal and read its mind, read the individual neural activity of all of its individual brain regions.
It's nuts. I always say, I think what I always say, maybe Heis is tired of hearing me say this, is that this is both awesome and scary at the same time, maybe. All right. So first of all, thanks a lot for your time today, Tomo. We really appreciate it. I believe, for everybody that's listening to this, Tomo Pereira of the Salk Institute in San Diego, you've received awards. You have a few things in publication. You have your own website, right?
Definitely.
If anybody listening wants to go just learn more about you and Salk, maybe on your website? What's your website?
Just talmolab.org. Talmo is just, T-A-L-M-O.
.org. All right. So, Heis and I like to do a lightning round of questions.
Great.
Fun. And so let's, without further ado, I'm just going to read off the first one. You ready?
Yep.
Name the person, Tomo, you'd most like to have dinner with, living or historical. And maybe it doesn't have to be a person in your case.
I'm just kidding.
And why? Tell us why.
Yeah, I think maybe Alan Turing, because that's a really interesting, it'd be very interesting person to talk to, given, the context of what we know about AI now, right? Like lots of his ideas, I think, about computing and the potential for intelligence were clearly way ahead of their time. And what I think would be very stimulating would be to have a conversation with Alan about, tell him where we actually landed now, and given that, what he thinks then we could build if we, with this kind of vision, starting from our starting point. I think that would be pretty wild.
Sweet. All right. Number two, if you didn't have the career that you have, what would you be doing instead, Tomo? And would it be in Brazil or the United States or somewhere else?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, definitely. While I grew up in Brazil, and while I was there, I was very into computer gaming. So I definitely, for a moment there, envisioned a career in esports. Like my life would have been very different.
Still very much around GPUs, though.
Yeah.
Still around GPUs. That's a constant. That's a constant in all timelines. Yeah.
Exactly.
When did you first start? When was the first time you actually got exposure to GPUs, Tomo? Is it before research at Princeton?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was probably when I was 12, when I, we didn't have a lot of money in Brazil. So to save money, I was just like, buy the parts typically use, right? Like all piecemeal. And I kind of just taught myself how to build the computer so that I could actually play Diablo 2, on my old like Radeon, whatever it was, 3 or something.
Nice. All right, we've got three more to go. Question number three is, what's the top destination on your vacation bucket list and why? And it could be a place you've already been.
Yeah, I'd have to say and encourage all your listeners to check out San Diego, California. It's hard to beat.
It is. I went to college in San Diego. I miss it. But wait a second. That's where you live. That's not your travel. Outside of San Diego, is there a place that you really want to go explore? Alaska? Or
yeah, probably not Alaska. That'd be great for overclocking my GPUs, you know, for cheap. But probably not ideal vacation destination. Definitely, you know, I'd like to take more time to explore more of Brazil. I mean, it's a huge country. I've explored some of Rio, and it's definitely been like one of the most beautiful places I could have ever imagined. So I'm sure there's a lot more to discover there.
I agree. Yeah, my wife is from Rio. It's taking place. Yeah. All right. This question we may have to take out because it's maybe not the most apropos question for these days. But if you're a reader, the best book you have read recently, tell us about it.
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe it might be a very, very interesting one. It's called Models of the Mind by Grace Lindsay. She's a computational neuroscientist, and it is a neuroscience book, but for a very general audience. And importantly, I think it discusses this premise of using AI to model, BI, biological intelligence, trying to understand the brain through principles of engineering and ultimately deep learning and the use of neural networks as a modeling construct. It's a really interesting read. It has some really cool background on the history of the field, and the very forward-thinking ideas, I believe, on where it could go.
Great. And this is Grace Lindsay, you said? Do you know Grace?
I don't personally know Grace.
Okay, but still. And you really are impressed by this work.
Yeah.
All right, so now that was our fourth question. Tell us, what's an interesting skill or hobby that you have that people would be surprised to learn about you? Not GPU computing, not neuroscience.
Not gaming.
Not gaming.
Dude, you're really killing me there. Okay, frankly, I think most people do know me for my intense love for computing, which consequently means I have a,
Do you have any skills around cooking?
Right. Well, that would probably be another. Yeah, definitely not. But I have a superhuman ability to stay, seated for extremely long periods of time. That has helped both my professional and gaming careers. So it would probably, surprise many people that I have a strong love for kayaking. Probably the only physical activity I really enjoy. And I think largely because it's one of the ones that you can do sitting down.
So, wow. So you live in San Diego. I can tell you that I did kayaking for a few semesters when I was in college in San Diego. It was great. A couple days a week, I had to go out to, what is it called? Mission Bay by SeaWorld. Do you ever do that?
Sure, yeah. We've gone on a couple of times. Ocean kayaking is pretty wild and a lot of fun.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally.
Especially around La Jolla. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Tomo.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Running AI Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And in our next episode, episode 4, we'll sit down with Dr. Jacob Newman of the University of East Anglia. He will discuss with us how AI is being used to better treat and more quickly diagnose vertigo. See you then.